This is West Virginia Morning. I'm your host, Glynis Board. The traditional start of the school year is coming like a freight train, and educational leaders are trying to prepare for the unknown.
We've got to put options in place for families that don't feel safe, and we have to put protocols in place to make sure that if we open these buildings, it is as safe as possible, and one size will not fit all.
That was West Virginia's Superintendent of Schools, Clayton Birch. We'll hear more from him, and we'll hear a story about efforts to save an endangered plant in Appalachia. This is West Virginia Morning. This summer, one of the biggest questions on parents and educators' minds is, what is school going to look like in the fall? And if there is an in-person option, should I even send my kids or return to work myself? Carol Lofton reports.
At the end of June, the American Academy of Pediatrics put out a recommendation that for kids, school should be in person in the fall. The recommendation basically says that school is not just about education. It's also the place kids get healthy meals and learn to socialize and have access to school-based health centers.
The mental health ramifications, the developmental impacts of not having that instructional learning and social interaction can really be very risky to children.
That's Dr. Lisa Costello. I spoke to her 2 weeks ago on a weekly Facebook Live series I've been hosting. She said recent research suggests that for whatever reason, young kids may not get or transmit the disease as easily as adults. And when they do get it, the disease is less severe than in older people.
What we also have found, very interestingly, is that children do not seem to spread the virus as much as they do when it comes to other diseases. Thus far, we know that children and adolescents, they don't seem to be transmitting this virus as much as, say, influenza.
She said that for kids themselves, the benefits of having in-person school seems to outweigh the risks. Of course, schools don't exist in an underage vacuum. There are teachers and bus drivers, custodians and cafeteria workers.
If it's not safe for students, if it's not safe for teachers and staff, then we need to reconsider whether we do it at all.
That's Clayton Birch, West Virginia school superintendent. Birch said they pushed the student school start date to September 8th and the teacher start date to August 24th to give the Board of Education and districts time to come up with a plan. They're still working on it.
These reentries have to be customized to the county. Each one of our counties has very, very different needs. We have many, many children who need school for a lot of reasons, and our schools realize that. But at the same time, we've got to put options in place for families that don't feel safe, and we have to put protocols in place to make sure that if we open these buildings, it is as safe as possible, and one size will not fit all.
There are no clear answers about how to keep students and staff safe. How do you properly distance on a school bus, or if you're five, or in an overfull classroom? The Board of Education has tried to address the contingencies by putting together a safety toolkit that all counties have to follow to reopen. But beyond that, one of the biggest challenges facing schools in West Virginia is that the state is far from having comprehensive broadband. And even if broadband was available in every county, not every family can afford internet services.
In 25 years of public education, I've always believed that public education is a great equalizer. I have always truly believed that public education will equalize all and everybody has an opportunity until March 13th. And when we saw the inequity, we knew there was some, we just didn't know how wide the gap was when it came to access of broadband.
Some kids were sent home with paper packets. Some had online options. By the end of the year, teachers reported that a lot of kids just stopped logging in or turning in the work. There are several initiatives to try and fix the internet inequity, though. Here's Bondi Shea Gibson, the superintendent for Jefferson County.
We've been working with the West Virginia Department of Education on a deal with a Sprint that we are hopeful will come to fruition, which would allow a full service unlimited data plan in full for the entire school year for any family that is within their coverage area provided we can purchase the appropriate hotspots for them. That is a technical problem that we are working through, but again, we are actively pursuing every possible means for getting Wi-Fi access inside the home to families.
Birch said the proposals he's seen are cost-effective, and they could help kids access the internet who wouldn't otherwise have it.
As a matter of fact, we're hearing costs as low as potentially $10 a month for unlimited data. That would be a game changer, trying to get more and more children access.
And if kids get access to internet, they could then enroll in West Virginia's Virtual School, an online education program available in all 55 counties for all middle and high school students. Birch said they've seen a huge uptick in students enrolling in the Virtual School and are anticipating a shortage of virtual teachers. He said the state board is encouraging employers to be as flexible as possible with their teachers and allow them to move to teaching a virtual classroom if they feel more comfortable with that. But even if the broadband issue was fixed, kids often don't have the skills required to stay accountable for lessons and homework. And there are a lot of kids who just need in-person school. Kids with individualized educational programs, who get therapy at school, who are fed, or for whom school is a safe space. Teachers are mandatory reporters for abuse and neglect cases, and since school has been out, referrals for abuse and neglect have dropped. Experts don't think it's because magically there is less abuse and neglect, but rather that kids are likely stuck at home with their abusers and no one is witnessing it. On the federal level, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and President Trump have been pushing for 5-day-a-week in-person reopening this fall. This has been met with a lot of criticism from across the aisle, including Governor Justice.
I will not be pressured by our president or anyone in regard to putting our kids back in school.
A couple of days ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a joint statement with the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, and the Schools Superintendents Association, clarifying and updating their late June recommendation. It said, returning to school is important for the healthy development and well-being of children, but we must pursue reopening in a way that is safe for students, teachers, and staff. Science should drive decision-making on safely reopening schools. Public health agencies must make recommendations based on evidence, not politics. We should leave it to health experts to tell us when the time is to best open up school buildings and listen to educators and administrators to shape how we do it. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from Marshall Health and the Charleston Area Medical Center. Researchers are trying to save a native plant only found in the Appalachian Mountains from extinction. The Allegheny Front's Andy Cubis has this story from Pennsylvania.
Canby's mountain lover, scientific name Pachystema cambyi, is one of the rarest plants in Pennsylvania.
It's not just rare in Pennsylvania, it's rare everywhere.
Steve Grund is a botanist with the Pennsylvania Natural Heritage Program, and he works out of the Pittsburgh office of the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy.
This plant could go extinct. It's a really plausible outcome.
And John Koonsman works out of the Conservancy's office in Harrisburg.
It was the first rare plant I ever looked for, and I was thrilled to death. I really was.
Why don't you go with us?
Okay. On a recent Saturday morning, I met up with Grund and Koonsman in Bedford, Pennsylvania, the northern limit of the plant's range. The Western Pennsylvania Conservancy bought this land, about 8 acres, from a private landowner in 1994, specifically to protect the Canby's mountain lover. The plant is in danger because of an insect called a scale. It sucks nutrients from the plant, including water. Grund explains the insect is here because of an invasive vine called the Asian bittersweet that serves as its host.
It's a terrible weed. It's particularly bad in this area. And so the fact that this Asian bittersweet is such a problem locally here and at this site is partly why the Canby's mountain lover is in trouble here, because it has that scale.
The botanists grabbed their weapon for this mission, a highly refined oil mixed with water loaded up in a squirt bottle.
It basically suffocates the scales. When they hatch from the egg, they're in a form called crawlers, and that's the only time in their life that they move. And while they're in that stage, they're vulnerable to this oil.
We walk several hundred yards uphill and into the edge of the forest.
We would call this a rocky wooded calcareous woods for a fancy name, or just a rocky wooded limestone woods.
When we get out there, I'll just drop this off the top.
Pretty soon we are up on a limestone cliff. It's about a 50-foot drop down. It looks like the sort of place you'd find rock climbers. There are pink flags scattered around, marking where the Cambies mountain lover is growing.
So that flag marked where we started treating last time.
It'd be very easy to walk right past it and never know you were so close to something so rare.
So here's the plant. It's a little shrub. It can get bigger than this, and it can kind of sprawl out.
The plant is evergreen, with little dark green leathery leaves. Soon it will have tiny white flowers. Right now, it looks a little bit like rosemary. How rare is this plant?
In Pennsylvania, we have three sites. This one, then there's one in the state park, Shawnee State Park. Then there's one on private land.
Botanists believe that there are fewer than 70 genetically distinct plants throughout its entire range, which extends as far south as Tennessee.
This is an Appalachian endemic. It only grows in limestone outcrops. You know, I can't say it's impossible that there are undiscovered populations, but we know better than we do for most plants.
I feel honored to be one of the few Pennsylvanians to have laid eyes on it.
That's true. Very few have seen it. Probably a couple dozen people, actually.
Grun gets down on the forest floor to get to work. He's perched on the edge of the limestone cliff. It's slightly terrifying. He puts on gloves to protect his hands and then sprays the plant with the oil.
Could you hand me my sprayer, please?
Next, he gets out a tiny, bright yellow notebook and magnifying glass that he wears around his neck.
They're very, very tiny. So what you do is you get a white piece of paper, and my field notebook works fine for that. You put it under the plant, then you flick it with your fingers. I'm not getting any crawlers. Maybe it's because I have the wrong glasses on.
It's not the glasses. It's the same thing the next few plants he sprays. No crawlers. And he thinks that's a good sign.
Maybe we timed it really well and got most of them last time.
The botanists, along with a couple volunteers, will be at this site all day, spraying and counting the plants. Right now, the count is about the same as the one made in 2012, when the first treatment of the scale was done. But they will also come out two more times this summer. It's a lot of effort for one small plant. But Grun says a team across the state, botanists, academics, park rangers, and citizens, chose this one to focus on because there's action they can take.
Often I feel like my job is to document the demise of rare plants. Here we have a case where there's something we can do about it. We don't know yet how successful we'll be long-term in treating it, but there's a chance that we can save these Pennsylvania populations and the rest of the range, and hopefully keep it off the endangered species list.
So why should someone care that a small plant that only grows in three areas of the state might go extinct? One reason often used is that you never know what plant might contain the cure for cancer. But Grun says it's not just about what benefits humans. It's the ecological connection, too.
When you lose one species, then you might lose the species that feeds on it. Then another species that species feeds on might explode exponentially. You know, these things are all connected, and sometimes we know what those connections are, and often we don't.
Botanists don't know anything about the role the Cambies mountain lover plays in its ecosystem, and they won't have a chance if it disappears and becomes something you'd find in a greenhouse. Again, John Kunzman.
We want to save this in its natural habitat, you know, not in a botanical garden somewhere. I want to see it growing where it should.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Kubis.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director is Andrea Billups. I'm your host and producer, Glynis Board. This is West Virginia Morning.